Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. Our website is redicecreations.com. We have over 1 year of free radio available for you in our archive. Interviews with interesting people doing important work and research into the alternative research subject matters like geopolitics, conspiracy, history, esoteric, occult topics, and much, much more. You can also sign up for membership on our website and get access to all our films, webcasts, video interviews, and of course our entire radio archive, with both hours going back to 2006. All information about this is available on our website, redicecreations.com. And I'm glad you've tuned in today and decided to join us. We have an exciting program ahead of us. We have author Rand Flemouth with us, who are, together with his wife, rather, has written a lot of books on the concept of Atlantis in Antarctica. And their latest book is called When the Sky Fell, Atlantis in Antarctica. And we're going to dive into this subject matter today and discuss things as the mystery of the Piri Reis map, the lost map of Christopher Columbus, Earth's shifting crust, the ice ages, mammoths, Greenland, sun activity, and much, much more. And I also want to give up the website here at the beginning of the program so you can take a look for yourself. Go to flem-ath.com for much more information about their book, their articles, and about the authors themselves, of course. But with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Rand. Thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me, Henrik.
It's really interesting having you here, and I've been following your work on and off kind of for many years, and I think you're one of these people who have been involved in this particular subject matter for a long, long time. Your name is associated very much with the research of Atlantis overall. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about how long you've been involved in this type of research and kind of what got you into it to begin with.
I started in 1976, if you can believe. I was in my mid-20s. I had just been trained as a librarian, so I have a master's degree in library science, and so I had some skills, and I was waiting for a job after I had a job interview one day, and so to, you know, sort of to pass the time while I found out whether or not I had the job, I had to wait the weekend, I decided to write a screenplay, and I started to work on a science fiction idea of aliens who had come to Earth and were hibernating here while they waited out events elsewhere in the galaxy. And so I thought to myself, that's kind of an interesting idea. I started to drop down notes, and I had the radio on, and on came a song by Donovan called Hail Atlantis.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I didn't know anything about Atlantis. I had heard, you know, Atlantis, just knew that it was a continent that had disappeared. And, you know, and in my story, I wanted to have the aliens hibernating under ice as a way to hide. So I thought to myself, well, why don't we put Atlantis under ice? That would make a good place for these guys to be hiding out. And so I went to the library, and then I didn't know anything about Atlantis at all. And I soon found out that, you know, everything that we know about Atlantis comes from the Greek philosopher Plato. And as I started to read more about Atlantis, I started to say, you know, well, you know, when I looked at the description that he was giving of the location of Atlantis, at first of all, it just seemed like gibberish, or like didn't make any sense at all. But as I started to do some more research and some more reading, and I was also researching Antarctica at the same time, I started to realize that what Plato was saying, which is rather revolutionary idea, was that there was an advanced civilization in the long past, and so I decided from the point of view of the screenplay, let's take this seriously. Let's imagine that it really was an advanced civilization. And when I did took that point of view, which was strictly for writing this screenplay, I suddenly discovered that Plato's account actually is an accurate depiction of the entire Earth's geography as seen from Antarctica. And this you can see this on our website, Atlantis and Antarctica. There's a very brief account of it there. But what it was, and here's the thing that was really mind-boggling for me, was that first of all he said that there was like only one ocean, and I have recently learned that oceanographers have come to the conclusion that there is only one ocean, that all the oceans are interconnected.
Yes.
You can best see that if you just take a globe off its hinges and put a look at Antarctica and ask yourself, what ocean is this in? From our perspective, which is really the European perspective, there's the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and the Pacific Ocean. Those are the big oceans. But from the perspective of Antarctica, all those oceans are really part of one ocean. And the thing that's remarkable about Plato's account, and he himself didn't claim to have written this account, he was relaying an account that his ancestor had acquired in Egypt, and the people in Egypt in turn had written records going back 9,000 years that from survivors of Atlantis. And that's where the account came from. So when I realized that the Earth's geography accurately was depicted in Plato's account of Atlantis, that seen from Atlantis, from Antarctica, the world is sort of like a dartboard. There's a little island. There's the island of Atlantis, which is huge. It's the size of North America.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's this huge world ocean, and Plato actually calls it, or the account in Plato's, the Egyptian priest called it the real ocean. And then surrounding this real ocean was this other continent, this vast continent, which was really basically the rest of the continents of the world combined. Because when you look at the world from Antarctica, it's like a dartboard. The bull's eye is Antarctica.
Right.
Then next, the first ring is the ocean, and then the big ring is the rest of the continents around it. And since you know you can actually see that as being an accurate depiction of the Earth's geography, I realized that what Plato was saying might just be true, that there really was an advanced civilization in the past that had mapped the world and was able to perceive and conceptualize the Earth's geography in a very few sentences. And that's what I found out in 1976. So then the big thing became to be, okay, now where do I go from here with this? And, you know, I mean, you look in the encyclopedias and they say, at that time, they were saying that Antarctica had been under ice for 55 million years.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't even, like, within the realm of possibility that there could have been a civilization there. It wasn't even possible at all. But then when I looked into that time period, this is the next thing that was really got me, was this time period that Plato gave. The Egyptian priest in around 600 BC spoke to Plato's ancestor Solon and said 9,000 years ago.
Mm.
So now we're looking at 9,600 BC, and this is precisely when all these incredible things were happening on the Earth. It was the end of the Ice Age. The ice caps on North America was going into a ferocious meltdown. The ocean level was rising really quickly in this century between 9,600 and 9,500 BC. There's just ferocious amount of ocean level changes. I mean, dramatic ocean level changes.
Yes.
And at the same time, there's extinctions happening at this time, and agriculture is beginning to occur. So, you know, I'm thinking, well, if he was right about the geography and he was right about what was happening at 9,600 BC, then maybe I should take this seriously. So that was the initial year I spent on that. And I The first thing that I really extensively researched was mythology. Because what I wanted to do was I wanted to recreate the story of Atlantis using world mythology from sources that Plato wouldn't have had access to. But I thought if I could reproduce the story of Atlantis using world mythology and still have enough evidence to point to Antarctica, that I would have then made a big step forward. So what I did, and for a year, all I did was read world mythology. And being a librarian, I was able to pull together every bits of books and articles about that. And I focused in, of course, in on the flood because it's such a well-known phenomena in world mythology. But within the flood myths, there was two elements that interested me that were unique. One was this notion that somehow the sky had changed, hence the title of our book, When the Sky Fell,
Yes.
or the sun had changed its position, which is another way of looking at it. That was one thing, and I call that the sun deluge motif. And that shows up around the world, all the way around the world, and I'll come back to that in a second. But the other thing, which was really interesting, was that before the flood, there's a notion of a lost island paradise. And so then I started focusing in on those. And there's about a half a dozen of these stories that are focused, talking about the conditions that existed before this great upheaval of 9600 BC, before this great flood. They spoke of this island continent. Let me give you a couple examples. Well, I live in British Columbia, which is on the west northwest coast of North America. We're on the Pacific side of things. And since the most famous theorist of Atlantis was Donnelly, Ignatius Donnelly, the American writer of the 19th century, he had focused on the Atlantic Ocean. And I can, I'll go, I'll come, I'd like to come back to that a little bit later. But my thinking was, if I could establish the story of Atlantis in using other locations, and BC was a perfect location because there's no way that anybody's going to say that Plato was here. And when you're talking about the ocean here, you're really not talking about the Atlantic Ocean, you're talking about the Pacific Ocean. Now, of course, that is just a mistake altogether. There is only one ocean, but nevertheless, if I could get a story as far away from Greece as I could, then it would substantiate Plato's account. So in British Columbia, there are two particular we call them First Nations people in Canada. Americans call them American Indians, or in Canada we call them First Nations. And the one First Nation that was really quite amazing is the Okanagan, and they live just in the interior of British Columbia here. On part of the tribe is in Washington State as well. Now they have a story of a place called Sumatuiulua, which was an island in the middle of the ocean, which was their original paradise, but which they were forced to flee from at the time of the flood. Now, I thought, well, that's interesting. Okay, here we have basically the same story as what Plato is telling us, except now we're in as far away from Plato as we can possibly be. And we take that sound, Suma Tuiulan, Ula, and we move to Japan. And in Japan, they have a story of their original homeland that existed before the flood, that was the original land, and it was called Onogoro-jima. So you have the same sound pattern, da 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 da. Okay, so then we go to ancient Iraq and Sumeria, the earliest civilization known to archaeology. And there's the story of Dilmun there. And that also is an island paradise. But also in our ancient Iran, there is in the Vesta, the Vedas, which are some of the oldest literature that humanity has, there's the Zen Vesta. And in the Zen Vesta, there is a story of an island paradise called Aryanavaishal. And it's the same pattern again. Da 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 da. Now, in each case, and now let me tell you about Aryanavaishal. Aryanavaishal is a land that is not only destroyed by a great flood, but it is also covered in snow and ice. So the original island paradise homeland is now covered in snow and ice in their mythology.
Really?
And in the case of Japan with Onogorojima, it's somewhere near the pole. And in the case of the Okanagan with Sumitomo, it's in the middle of the ocean and it's associated with whiteness. So here you have from British Columbia, Japan, and parts of the Middle East that perhaps Plato had a little, they might have had some, but he probably didn't. And all the stuff that we've learned about this has come long since Plato has died. But here you have the basic elements. You have an island in the middle of the ocean associated with whiteness that is near the pole that is now covered in snow and ice and was destroyed by a great flood many, many years ago. And the people were forced to flee that homeland in ships, canoes, etc., and make their way to another land. Which is very different story from example of what archaeology is telling us about the people of the New World. In the story of how people come to the New World, according to archaeology, it's sort of a replay of the American conquest of the West. It's they're moving there because there's a better land ahead, and they're going to follow their way down into America and have a better land. So, in other words, they're leaving their lands because they see a better land ahead, which is not what the First Nations are saying. What the First Nations are consistently saying is that they lived in an island paradise, that they were catastrophically displaced from it, and only survived barely by coming into the new land. So the new land was not a place where they chose to come, but where they ended up after this great destruction. So that was what I learned in the first year, if you like. And
Maybe we can sorry to cut you off. I just want to ask you here if we need to, in some way,
sure.
then kind of I guess break down the myth regarding the ice sheet and how long there has been that, because that seems to be the biggest kind of bump in the road, so to speak, to work against your theory and your ideas in that sense. Because if we look at a few other scholars like D.S. Allen and J.B. Dallaire, for instance, I think that they've written quite a few, many pieces on the fact that the Ice Age wasn't extended for such a long period of time that we're believed, which it is believed, have been the case. Or how do you explain the whole Ice Age issue? And is that something that is a problem, so to speak, in your research?
Absolutely. Well, that's when I got onto the theory of Earth crust displacement and started corresponding with Charles Hapgood. Let me just say that what I think the ice ages is. The ice ages are those areas of the Earth's surface that are in the polar zones. Today, there is an ice age in Greenland and in the Arctic Ocean and in Siberia and northern Alaska and northern Canada. There's also an ice age in Antarctica. There is an ice age right now. It's there. What we think is the variable is the Earth's crust or mantle. It shifts catastrophically, as in the myths of the falling sky, and moves the outer shell of the Earth into or out of the polar zone. If you're moving out of the polar zone, as North America did 12,000 years ago, then there's ferocious melting and the ocean level is rising. If you're moving into the polar zone, as Siberia was, then you're having all these temperate zone animals suddenly dying off and suddenly it becoming a barren tundra. And the same thing was happening in the southern hemisphere. In the case of Lesser Antarctica, which is on the exact opposite side of the Earth to Siberia, you were having ice forming where there had been previously a temperate zone. And let me explain how that has to be true.
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, I believe it was, nine Russian scientists from the Russian Academy of Sciences published an article in Science magazine, the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, explaining that a site at 71 degrees north in Siberia, that is 5 degrees within the Arctic Circle, a place called Yana on the coast of Siberia on the Arctic Ocean, at 30,000 years ago, that this place had people. There was people living there, and they were hunting temperate zone animals.
Yeah,
and you go through the list of the animals that are listed that are there, and they're all like animals that could not survive even 1 year at that latitude nowadays. Maybe one or two of the dozen or so animals that they were finding there could still live there. I think the reindeer and the Arctic fox or something. But the other animals that were living there couldn't live 1 year in that place. So what that tells us is that our notion of what was happening in the far north, what we call the far north, in Siberia, could have actually been also happening on the exact opposite side of the Earth in Lesser Antarctica.
Yeah.
Because today, when you look at any place on the Earth's surface that is on the exact opposite side of the Earth, they're getting the same amount of sunlight. So New Zealand, for example, is pretty close to being antipodal to England. It's a little bit warmer because it's closer to the equator, but it's just about on the opposite side of the Earth. Of course, the North Pole is antipodal to the South Pole. Every place on the Earth's surface has an antipodal. So, and in every case, you're getting the same amount of sunlight, approximately. I mean, you can't count, climate and wind patterns and ocean currents and clouds and things affect it. But the amount of sunlight that you're getting and the average temperatures that you're getting is the same on any place on the Earth's surface that is antipodal. So if we know that at 30,000 years ago, and according to the most recent evidence from northern Siberia, that people were living in northern Siberia 30,000 years ago, it means that people could have been living in Lesser Antarctica 30,000 years ago.
That's the
implication of the article in Nature in 2004.
Yes, and there have subsequently been coming out a lot of articles as new discoveries are taking place. For instance, if we talk about Greenland, just a couple of years ago now, that when they started drilling down, they found things like pine needles, they found blades of grass, different leaves. And basically the idea, I think, which has developed here is that once they think that Greenland, just listen to the name, Greenland, actually once was lush, had forests and so forth. But I think the only argument at this point is how long ago back this actually was a green place. Do you have a theory about that, Rand?
In the case of Lesser Antarctica, I believe it was only 12,500 years ago. I mean, 12,000 years ago, 11,500 years ago, I believe, Lesser Antarctica, which is the size of Western Europe, was temperate. and had a civilization. In the case of Greenland, Greenland's a little bit more complex because you have to go back 100,000 years before you have Greenland without ice. Greenland is one of those interesting situations that proves the theory of Earth crust displacement, in my view. Let's look at the Greenland in a little bit more detail. Mm. Now, Greenland contains 90% of the glaciation in the Northern Hemisphere. That is, 90% of the ice in the Northern Hemisphere is on Greenland. 90%.
Wow.
But, and here's the thing that is totally paradoxical to the existing establishment. There isn't snowfall in central Greenland. And central Greenland gets as much snowfall as the Sahara Desert gets rain. It's a polar desert. In other words, it's not snowing where the greatest ice cap is.
Hmm.
And moreover, if you go through the thickest period point of ice on Greenland, where it's the thickest, and you go antipodal to it, you go right straight through the center of the Earth and you pop out the other side, you're on what's called Greater Antarctica, the Antarctica side towards the Indian Ocean. And that's also where the greatest ice sheet in the world is. And it's also the same situation. Miles and miles of thick of ice, yet no snowfall.
Hmm. I never heard that. That is interesting. So, do you know what is just a? Is it just a freak weather pattern that takes place over Greenland, or do you know why it does not snow there?
Yes, I can tell you exactly why it doesn't snow there. Because of the Earth, the way the Earth's crust is located now in what we call the Arctic. Arctic Ocean, weather patterns come from the west to the east. Now, they come off the Pacific, and the clouds come up, and they go over the Rocky Mountains, and they drop their rainfall through the Canadian prairies and the American prairies, and as you get further east, there's less, and then by the time you get to Greenland, you're once again you're pretty the moisture that has been dropped on North America has been expended. So there isn't any possibility of dropping more moisture on Greenland by the time the wind patterns bring the clouds from the moisture source, which is the Pacific Ocean, to Greenland. Now, this wasn't the case 12,000 years ago, when the Earth's crust was in a different position. 12,000 years ago, we believe that the part of the Earth's crust that was at the North Pole was in the Hudson Bay in Canada. Now you're getting a different kind of wind patterns that are happening. Ocean currents are different, wind patterns are different. And what you're getting in what at that time would have been the North Atlantic Ocean is you're getting counter forces that bring the moisture off the North Atlantic. They come back sweeping over and they hit the mountains of eastern Greenland, and then they deposit their snow in central Greenland.
Hmm.
That's how the ice got there. Now, there is no other explanation being offered. None. No other explanation being offered of how Greenland got its ice. The Earth crust displacement theory is the only theory that's being offered to explain that. When you only have one theory, it should be taken seriously. Especially since no other theories seem to be capable of it.
Yeah.
Now, there is one other theory that has been proposed, and it only happened in 2008. And that was, and here there's two physicists, one in Switzerland and one in Brazil. And I won't even attempt to try to pronounce their names, so you can look them up in the book. And they're also on the web. They're also, it's easily accessible if you put into Google something like Siberia and axis change. You'll probably come across the article.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, these two physicists, read the account from the Russian scientists about what was happening in Yana, and they said, well, look, this is not explicable if the Earth's if Siberia has this relationship to the Earth's axis as it is today. So there must have been a change in the latitude of Siberia in the past 12,000 years. That's what they concluded, which is what Hapgood concluded in the 1950s, and we have been arguing ever since 1976 or 77. And so what they proposed as the explanation for this was that there was another planet in our solar system, and that when it went out of control and came by the Earth so closely that it changed the Earth's axis.
Mm-hmm.
Earth's axis changed, and they believe that before the displacement, the axis came through central Greenland. In other words, Greenland was at the North Pole before this catastrophe occurred.
Yes.
Now, while I am so pleased that we have established scientists saying that this is a problem that requires an explanation, you know, Siberia having temperate zone animals at 5 degrees within the Arctic Circle certainly does require explanations. I don't agree that axis shift was the cause, because the problem with their theory, which we explained in the last chapter of When the Sky Fell, is that even if the Arctic Circle was centered on Greenland, yes, you could account for some of the ice in Greenland. You could account for some of the ice in Europe. You could even account for some of the ice in eastern Canada. But you could not explain the vast ice sheet that existed in British Columbia and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I think the theory is unable to do that. Now, the Earth crust displacement theory can explain the glaciation patterns globally, including the ones in British Columbia and Alaska, as being another area that had been within the pole in the past 100,000 years.
So just to clarify here then, Randy, what you're saying is that what we're probably looking at is that an extra solar system planet coming into our system, and hence that the effect of that is causing massive upheaval on our planet and catastrophe and so forth, and even destabilizing the entire crust of our planet then. Is that what you're saying?
That was what they were saying caused the axis to shift. I don't support that theory particularly.
Okay.
I congratulate them on attempting to try to solve the unsolved problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we could step back a little bit on the philosophy of science here for a second here, all of science progresses by resolving unsolved problems. So unsolved problems is the basic currency of the value of a theory.
Mm.
And the unsolved problem that we're trying to solve here, and they were trying to solve, was how do you explain these people living with temperate zone animals 30,000 years ago in what we today consider to be a place so cold that nobody would even consider living there?
Yeah, yeah.
And the answer that they came up with was this theory of the axis change and the other planet coming through. Now, I don't support that particular theory,
mm-hmm.
because I think it was an Earth crust displacement, not an axis change, that caused this problem.
And what caused the why did the Earth crust displaced?
Why did the Earth crust shift?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, that's another whole controversy, and I'm not saying that I'm having a final solution on this. However, when we did the first edition of this book in 1995, we basically said we didn't know. And the proposal, let's go through the proposals. The original proposal that was put forward by Hapgood and his colleague James Campbell was that the weight of the ice caps being lopsided to the Earth's axis and being the centrifugal force of the Earth spinning caused the weight of the ice sheets to shift the Earth's crust. Now, when they, when Hapgood and Gamble took this theory to Albert Einstein, and they did work extensively with Albert Einstein over the course of about 3 years, and Einstein wrote like 10 letters to Hapgood, at least 10 letters. There may be more that we haven't found. And he wrote other letters to other people about Hapgood's book. His theory, rather. Einstein said, no, that is not going to be sufficient force. And what we're really looking for is we're looking for a steady force that dead ends. Like an abrupt force would probably, he thought that something coming by, another planet coming by, for example, anything that would come by and move the Earth's axis would probably shatter the Earth. It was Einstein's opinion that the axis shift was really unlikely. Any force that could shift the Earth's axis would be sufficient, would probably be so great that it would shatter the Earth. Mm. We wouldn't even be here if that had happened. Mm. So that's why he liked the idea of just the outer shell of the Earth moving and spent so much time on it. Now, after the publication of the first edition of When the Sky Fell, a fellow wrote to me, his name is Gerard Friedman. I think he's in his 30s. He made a fortune from making games, you know, these computer games, mm-hmm. and retired very early. But he knew a lot about magnetics because he used them in the games and stuff. And he became convinced, and I think it's probably the most viable theory, that is that the sun is the culprit here. Hmm. That just as we have the occasional hurricanes on the Earth, and great big hurricanes like really huge hurricanes can come along every once in a while, like Katrina, the one that took out New Orleans.
Yes.
So too on the sun, over longer periods of time, there are what he calls solar typhoons. And these solar typhoons, which happen very slow, that happen over a long period of time, can last for months, send out electromagnetic storms throughout the solar system in waves of electromagnetic waves. And as the Earth is coming, spinning around the sun, it can enter into one of these electromagnetic waves. And as it does, the steady force of this wave applied to the pole, because the Earth is a magnet, and this is magnetic force, so it applies itself strictly to one of the poles. As it hits the Earth's axis, the energy goes down into the center of the Earth and heats up the center of the Earth, and that liquefies the relationship between the mantle and the core, and also the mantle and the crust, making what is tarry substance, just like about 40 miles below us, is about a very tarry substance called the asthenosphere, into a liquid type, like when it heats up, it becomes like lava, it flows.
Yes.
But when it's in its normal state, it's very tarry, and it would be sticking, it's very gradual movements that happen, as in plate tectonics, for example. But when a solar typhoon, when we go through an electromagnetic storm from the sun that has experienced a solar typhoon, then the Earth's interior heats up, and the relationship between the crust and the area immediately below it and the mantle changes. The asthenosphere, which means weak zone, becomes liquid-like, and then the steady force of this electromagnetic storm, as we go through this patch in our orbit, continues to push the crust until it tips over.
Hmm.
As we leave the area of the storm, then everything cools down, and the asthenosphere once again becomes tar-like, and the new relationship of the crust and or mantle to the inner parts of the Earth is reestablished, and we have a different era, if you like.
Hmm.
And, I believe that the solar typhoon theory makes the most sense because it answers the kind of questions that Einstein was requiring. He wanted a steady force that could end, and he tended to think it was probably external.
That's really interesting.
That's
really interesting regarding the solar typhoon. I mean, just recently, or a couple of months ago, maybe a year actually by now, they did record what they were calling a solar tsunami, among other things. A very interesting phenomena, which seems to be basically when you have a CME, a corona mass ejection, an effect of that is almost like a tsunami, a wave moving through the sun. But do you know if scientists yet have recorded these solar typhoons, or if this is something that...
No,
they haven't.
Okay. No, they have not. They have not, but then you see, I believe what is the register of that? To me, what is registered of it was what happened 9,600 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Catastrophic climatic change. North America, which had been an ice-covered continent, becoming an ice-free continent. Antarctica, which had been partly temperate, becoming totally polar. And then all the areas in between, the great changes that were occurring. And this is the thing about the Earth crust displacement theory that is so valuable from a philosophy of science point of view, is that it can resolve numerous unsolved problems. Such as the cause of the ice ages, the cause of climatic change. The origins of agriculture is something that I spend a lot of time on because it's occurring around that time. The extinctions of the animals. All of these unresolved problems and persistently unresolved problems are suddenly the natural outcome of one of these solar typhoon earth crust displacements. That's what we're saying in When the Sky Fell. We're saying that everything that we saw 11,500 years ago was to be expected if this had happened.
Very interesting. And do you know, or do you or your colleague or the younger guy who wrote to you about this, do you guys have any theory about what triggers one of these solar typhoons? Is this a regular cycle thing that seems to be happening on the sun, or is it because of something else?
Jared believes that is a natural cycle that occurs on the sun, just like we have the occasional big Katrina-type hurricanes. We also have solar typhoons on the sun. There is another explanation, and that is now you're getting into beyond our solar system. And that is that there could be, from the center of our galaxy, events occurring that send particles towards our solar system, and that those particles end up in the sun and disturb the sun's normal activity, heighten its activity. So there could be an extra solar system source to this, a galactic source, if you like, to the change in the sun. But really, this is total speculation. We have no idea. Even the notion that the solar typhoons are the cause of the crustal displacement is simply a hypothesis.
Yes.
What is not a hypothesis, though? What is factual are these factual things. Things like Greenland having the most ice but not snowfall, Antarctica having the most ice but no snowfall, massive extinctions occurring in Siberia, North America, and South America, but not in Africa and in the South Pacific because of the way of the crustal displacement occurs. Let me just try to get the visualization for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a basketball in your hands and your palms are facing each other, and then you twist your wrist, you'll notice that towards your nose, there's a great amount of change. But at the palms of your hand, there's little change. So when an earthquake displacement occurs, some parts of the Earth are experiencing vast changes, such as, in the last case, North America, South America, Antarctica, and Siberia.
Mm.
Other areas, equivalent to where the palms of your hands are in a basketball, for example, would be Africa and the South Pacific. Now, you don't have massive extinctions happening in Africa. You've got elephant, you've got giraffes, you've got large animals in Africa that exist today.
Mm-hmm.
Those counterparts in North America that existed 12,000 years ago are now gone. The mammoths are gone. The saber-toothed tigers are gone. The giant sloths of South, all sorts of animals that were on the what I call the ring of death, the sort of the greatest area of displacement. It's actually 83 degrees longitude west of Greenwich. That is where that longitude, if you like, is where the greatest changes occur.
Yes.
And it goes through North America, South America, Antarctica, and Siberia. That's where the big deaths occur.
Well, I'm reminded of another article I remember we put up on Red Ice a while back about mammoths and the other, what they call great beasts, were actually peppered with material from outer space. They've been examining 8 different tusks, and these were dating some 35,000 years ago, according to this article. But anyway, what it showed was signs of that some kind of material, meteor fragment or something like that, had been peppering these tusks and probably contributed to the mass die-off as well of the mammoths. I don't know if you're aware of that research or not, Rand.
No, I hadn't heard of that, but that would not surprise me. I think we live in a very tranquil time period in Earth's history. We're causing our own problems with global warming, etc. However, relative to what the Earth as a planet has gone through at various stages, as, for example, 11,500 years ago, we have a very tranquil thing, and there are many. It's interesting that in the account of Atlantis, the Egyptian priest who is telling the story says straightforward: there are many and manifold destructions of mankind.
Hmm.
This is a direct quote, by all sorts of various type ways. The flood, but there have been many floods and many other great destructions. So, it isn't just an earth crust displacement. It's not like we're saying that the Earth has only experienced earth crust displacements and that's the only catastrophe.
Sure,
We get hit by asteroids, by comets. There are all sorts of destructions that happen in the Earth that we're only beginning to recognize now.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we round things off here for the first hour, just talking a little bit more about sun activity and I guess the general idea that, well, you mentioned that we're living in a fairly kind of tranquil period right now, but what about the upcoming solar activity in 2012 and all this talk about returning of a more catastrophical age in regards to what's going to happen on planet Earth? Is that something that you've looked into at all?
Here's the thing. The solar activity, which we believe to be the ultimate cause of the displacements, goes in 11-year cycles. And 2012 is going to be one of those years when we have more activity on the sun. What is unique about 2012, and which is registered in the Mayan calendar, which is quite amazing, but I'd like to discuss a little bit about why astronomy is so advanced in the past and in the next hour. But the thing that is quite extraordinary about 2012 is that the Earth, it's sort of like if you imagine it like a merry-go-round or a carousel at where the horses are going up and down and around.
Mm-hmm.
We are going up and down through the Earth's through the galactic plane of the galaxy. At 2012, we will be at the midpoint. So if there are any things coming out of the center of the galaxy towards along that plane, then that will hit us, our solar system. So in that sense, it's not completely impossible that something could happen. However, I tend not to think that it will happen. You have to bear in mind that we're getting these solar activities every 11 years, and it's been like there's been nearly 2,000 of them since the last Earth crust displacement. So the chances of it happening are like 2,000 to 1 against. But those are pretty good odds if you consider the 2,000 to 1, which the consequences is if we hit that one, it's the end of civilization.
Yeah, that's right.
Is not to be discounted completely.
Yeah. Well, very, very interesting. I definitely want to carry on talking more with you here in our second hour for Red Eyes members, Rand. But to run things up here for this hour, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your website and, of course, give us the title again of your book and how people can go about getting a copy if they're interested in reading more about this research.
Okay, the website is, as you said, is Flemath, F-L-E-M, like Fleming, hyphen or dash A-T-H, like bath without a B, .com. And on there, you will be able to get the book. It's an ebook, the new edition of When the Sky Fell. The first edition was called In Search of Atlantis, as a subtitle. The new edition, Atlantis in Antarctica, is an ebook, and it's been updated completely and revised, and a whole lot of stuff has been added to it. That is only available as an ebook, and you can get it from mobipocket.com. This is off of our website. You can see where to get it. If you have a Kindle, you can get it as a Kindle. You don't need to have a special device, although you can have it. You can get it on an iPhone, you can get it on a BlackBerry, but you can also get it on a PC or a laptop. And the software is free for turning your computer or any device that you have into a book reader. And then the cost of the book is $7, $6.95 U.S. And you can just download it, and you'll have it there almost immediately. So I also like just to mention that my wife and I also have a thriller out called Forbidden Manuscript, which is actually outselling When the Sky Fell. We can talk about that a little in the second half hour if you want.
Absolutely. And again, the website is flemauth.com. We'll have this
flemauth.com.
We'll have this these links up on redeyescreations.com as well, so you can click through from our website easily. But stay with us, and we'll be right back. We have much more for you in our members area. Hour 2 is available now with Rand Flemauth. Join us as we talk about the lost map of Christopher Columbus, the Piri Reis map, and the Map Amundi, and German Jesuit scholar Athanasius Kircher, who wrote on these subjects and about these maps. There is a connection to the Map Amundi and fragments of this, which is believed to be the Piri Reis map, to Aswan in Egypt, or Syene, as it was used to be called. The Map Amundi has its center over Aswan, and there's a relationship to the Tropic of Cancer, and we must go back to about 5,700 years ago, when the Tropic of Cancer and Aswan was aligned or linked up. So we discussed this relationship and the implications of this. We talk more about Christopher Columbus. The Catholics, Portuguese, and the Vatican knew that they were going to find land. Columbus didn't simply stumble over the Americas. We also discuss Montezuma, Cortes, and the myth of Aztlan. We talk about the ice melting at Antarctica. Global warming or displacement of the ice seems to be taking place. There's melting in some areas and growing in others. Will it reveal something under the ice? We talk about Lake Vostok, New Schwabenland, Operation High Jump, Admiral Byrd, Hollow Earth theories, a possible magnetic pole shift, and we end things on the amazing site of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. So don't miss this jam-packed Hour 2 with Rand Flemauth coming up. Click on Members, join us for Hour 2. If you're not yet a member, simply click on Subscribe, sign up, and get instant access. It's only 16 euro cents per day. Try it out for 3 months and enjoy our entire radio programs, films, webcasts, video interviews, and much more. Upcoming on the show, we have Ben Abba. He's going to talk about immortality and very, very old people walking the earth. We have Robert Bouval coming on the program to talk about his new work on the Black Genesis. Joseph P. Farrell will join us to talk about the Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy and Exotic Matter. We have MEP Marta Andreasen and Anthony from We Are Change Ireland coming on the program as well to talk more about the important upcoming Lisbon Treaty. But more now after some music.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Across the universe, float me under like a restless wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe. Suns, it calls me on and on across the universe.